the financing window was wide open. The companies were crowding into the financing window, which meant that ipso facto, the companies thought your cash was worth more than their shares. And they knew a lot about the value of their shares. For myself, however, more particularly, I sold about 25% of my junior holdings, because by doing so, I could take all the capital out of the sector that I had invested in the sector. I could give up 25% of my upside and eliminate 100% of my downside, which sounded like a hell of a trade to me when that period of high mortgage rates fell by 50%. And there were these foreclosures all over the place. And I was talking about the wealth destruction. I remember Doug turning to me and says, there's been no wealth destruction. None. The house didn't go away. It's just that the wealth is going to go back to where it should have been to begin with, in strong hands, not weak hands. The wealth wasn't destroyed. It merely changed hands. All say that peak oil demand occurs in 2030 or 2032, which is ridiculous. Peak oil demand won't occur in my lifetime. For the record, I'm a healthy 72-year-old. Likely won't occur in your lifetime, Andy. Mm-hmm. And when people do net present value calculations, if you cut off the calculation in 2032, you get a much lower tail value than if you cut off the calculation in 2065, which is when I counted out.
Rick Rule, good morning to you, my friend. How are you?
I'm fine, Andy. The better for being here talking with you.
It's always my pleasure. It really is. And let's get started. I really want to start with, we've been talking about the last several times about we took some profits, we took some money off the table with the expectation of a pullback in the miners and a correction in gold. And just because we both thought, and I paraphrase, that this was getting a bit frothy, if you would, and you and I being the contrarians, if you would, that was making us, was making me nervous, if you would. And it's always just leaning into discipline and taking some money off the table. Now we've had a pullback. Talk about that, and maybe not so much expectation, but what to do with that pullback. Are you thinking of redeploying funds? Is it becoming more attractive to you again, if you would? Talk about that.
First of all, what you said at the beginning is only partly true. Yes, I thought the junior market was too frothy. The financing window was wide open. The companies were crowding into the financing window, which meant that ipso facto, the companies thought your cash was worth more than their shares. And they knew a lot about the value of their shares. For myself, however, more particularly, I sold about 25% of my junior holdings, because by doing so, I could take all the capital out of the sector that I had invested in the sector. I could give up 25% of my upside and eliminate 100% of my downside, which sounded like a hell of a trade to me. And I redeployed simultaneously. I took about half the money, put some of it into physical gold, which means I redeployed it in the same sector, but at less risk, with less upside. And I put some of the money into each of Franco-Nevada, Wheaton Precious, and Agnico Eagle, which is to say I de-risked my portfolio. I took the other half of the proceeds and I put it in the oil and gas business. I moved money from a sector that had been hated and became loved to a sector that was still hated in anticipation of hopefully repeating the process 3 or 4 or 5 years from now. I am looking for further deployments in the junior sector, but what I will do from here on out in the sector is I will attempt to find opportunities that I think are more compelling than the opportunities I own, and I will finance new investments with capital from investments I've already made. I'm not going to be adding money to the junior sector. I'm going to be redeploying capital I already have invested in the sector. And I'm eagerly doing that. I'm not finding very much joy in the private placement market because the private placement market seems now to be priced to suit the issuer as opposed to suit the check writer. In particular, you know my fondness for warrants, Andy. And neither the issuers nor the investment bankers these days seem to know how to spell warrant. But I am seeing some opportunities in the aftermarket where some companies appear to hold attractive relative valuations, and other companies, particularly the early stage explorers and the prospect generators, are attracting very little love. So the idea that I could go from a developer name, which is selling at 2x net asset value, to a prospect generator that I think is selling at 25 or 30% of net asset value, that seems to me to be a fairly easy trade. Albeit I'm way early on that trade. I'll get no joy in that trade in the market in the near term. It won't be something where I'll fill at 40 cents and the market will immediately go to 60 or 65. That's not the way it works. I'm looking to go somewhere at 40 cents that 2 years from now will be at $2.
Got it. And well answered too. I per recently participated in a private placement, and the only reason that it was attractive to me is because I was given a full warrant, if you would. Other than that, I've been approached, I don't know how often, but a lot, and there were no warrants involved, and so I stayed away. So that's the strat. It wasn't into my advantage. I saw no upside in doing that, just giving them my money.
We're in a market right now where some of the better active managers and many of the passive managers, the ETFs, are experiencing inflows and they have to put the money out. And the consequence of that is that the managers are saying to companies that they like, if you have a compelling use of funds, I'm ready to fund it. If conditions change, even temporarily, and they have outflows, that source of funds goes away. I mean, instantaneously. The second thing that you need to understand is that there's reasonably consistent inflows into the ETFs. And what that means is that issuers have to get themselves bigger. If they get bigger and they have greater trading liquidities, they get included in indexes, and they get added to the ETFs. They get these passive flows. And it's important to understand those two factors, and it's important to shape your own investment strategies around those two factors.
Got it. Let's talk a little bit. Let's pivot a little bit, really about the general economy here. You are a very experienced banker, and I would dare to say, I don't want to speak for you, but I dare to say that's more or less how I've become to know you, if you would. So you have a big pulse, if not, I don't know, you know what's going on in the economy. So talk to me about that. It looks like we have been, but I sound like a broken record. It looks like we've been in a recession for several months, or we're going into one. What are you seeing in the general economy, and what does that exactly mean?
With the caveat that I see it from a credit lens, I'm not an economist. I think that's a really important dichotomy. I'm that guy where the rubber meets the road.
That's where to be, though.
Yeah, my job is to lend out money that you get paid back, you know. Commodity prices are telling me that we're in a recession, that it isn't as though the recession is nigh, and I can't cite any particular jobless statistics or anything like that. But I look as an example at the copper price, and I note that 7% of world copper supply is now suspended. Cobre Panama, Grasberg, Kamoa-Kakula, and the copper price in the face of a 7% reduction in overall supply. Remembering that prices are set on the delta between supply and demand, they're not set across 100% of the production chain. That 7% decline in production in a market that was already experiencing a production deficit has only led to a 5% increase in the copper price. Tells me that near-term demand for copper is very weak relative to our expectations. I would have the same comment about oil and gas pricing and nickel pricing.
I was going to go there. Go ahead.
We are seeing a circumstance where, on a global basis, ex-Saudi and the US, frankly, oil production at its best is cresting. And the oil quota is weak. That tells me that in the near term, there is near-term demand problems around oil and gas. So my spider sense tells me that on a global basis, it isn't as though we are approaching recession or that there's fear of recession, because I'm seeing demand softening in real terms in materials that get used to satisfy demand immediately. As a banker, I see something else. I see the very beginnings of credit contraction. I see banks in the United States in particular that are dealing as best they can with at least three challenges. One is mark-to-market valuations on their long-term assets, either their bond portfolios or their long-term mortgage portfolios, where they've lent money for 8 years or 10 years at fixed interest rates. And then the interest rate went up. That lowers the net present value of their flow of loan repayments at the same time that they're financing that 8 or 10 year income stream with very short-term deposits. So their cost of funds and deposits is going up and their yield is going down. That's a time spread. That time spread issue is what wrecked the US savings and loan industry, and it wrecked Silicon Valley Bank. And I'm seeing it happen in real time to, in particular, big bank portfolios around the country. You will note, some of your listeners won't know, but you will note that through vagaries in accounting, the big banks are allowed to look at their loan and bond portfolios and carry them as held to maturity, which means that they aren't forced to mark their assets to market. A bond could be selling in the aftermarket at 60, and if a bank had it in its held to maturity bucket, they could carry it on the books at 100, even though the market for the bond is 60. And there's beginning to be some very yawning valuation gaps between mark to market and what I call mark to myth. That's the first problem. The second problem is a persistent weakness in the United States in income, commercial, and industrial mortgages, particularly office mortgages, and particularly in big cities. We've seen one after another complexes that were 5 or 6 years ago valued at $700 million being sold at auction for 80 or 90 or $100 million. There's a lot of rot in bank portfolios around commercial real estate mortgages. There is a lot of extended pretend going on, but the circumstance around the market absorption of those projects isn't occurring. The third is that banks are beginning to be concerned about the whole range of what used to be called subprime or non-investment grade credits. That could be consumer credit, which is to say consumer durables, auto loans, credit card debts. But for 40 years, the rates on those loans were high enough that they could overcome the default rate. If you had a 5 or 6% default rate, but you were charging 25% on money that you were acquiring at deposit of interest rates, which is say 3 or 4%, that 21% gross margin hit a lot of defaults in. There is, I think, in this circumstance, a lot of rot left there. Let's say, as an example, that an Amazon employee making $20 an hour was able, albeit barely, to sustain his auto loan and sustain his revolving consumer debt, which is a fancy way of saying his credit card. But he got laid off this week. What was a strained but performing loan now is a distressed loan. At the same time that the banking industry for 40 years has been able to extend credit to deserving commercial borrowers that were not investment grade, but borrowers who the industry was fairly convinced enjoyed tailwinds in their business and would ultimately be able to refinance at a lower cost of capital. With interest rates rising and credibility, pardon me, credit markets themselves, credit availability tightening, the assumptions that were made around what were formerly deserving but non-investment grade credits is tightening up substantially. And we're seeing that. When I sort of announced to the market a year ago that I looked forward to being myself an increasingly aggressive lender in the oil and gas business, in the royalty business, in the gas gathering business, I was astonished by the number of high quality but below investment grade borrowers who came to me. Private family offices that have traditionally had sort of $100 million revolving credit lines with money center banks, having the banks say, by the way, we won't be renewing. We're going in oil and gas to investment grade, triple B or better. These are borrowers that have 40 or 50 year track records in the oil and gas business.
Gosh.
Businesses are in very good shape. Facing money center banks who are de-emphasizing non-investment grade credits and, oh, by the way, de-emphasizing oil and gas. And I suspect, although I don't know, that that's occurring in other industries as well. A private family might own a paint factory, very good business. Localized monopolies because paint is fairly cheap and very heavy to transport. So, as an example, a paint factory in Salt Lake City doesn't have to compete with a paint factory in Los Angeles. I suspect that you're seeing private family businesses in a variety of industries beginning to experience credit availability problems that those families haven't seen since, say, 1982.
That far.
I mean, listen, this period, 1982 to 2022, I think will go down in history as the most benevolent economic climate, probably in recorded history. We had declining nominal and real interest rates. We had very, very, very strong US dollar. We had great credit availability. We had great liquidity, money printing. We had globalization where the cost of your inputs, if they came from elsewhere, came down. Doesn't get better than that. And it didn't. Beginning in 2022, both the nominal and the real interest rates went up. Various impediments to free trade came to occur. By the way, your taxes went up the whole time. So while the next period won't be catastrophic, it also won't be easy. And people have been conditioned to expect easy, and their expectations must change.
So you mentioned liquidity, and you just said 1982. You and I both lived, it wasn't that long ago, 2008, 2009-ish, if you would, where there was a liquidity problem. And I say problem in a very relative term, but yeah, and I've been just trying to work this out. Do you see that? That's obviously a possibility, but do you see that more of a probability now, looking at the banking sector, if you would, in liquidity?
I don't know, is my honest answer. A black swan, by its nature, is something that doesn't lurk in the public view. In retrospect, when I look at my own behavior pre-2008, I'm disgusted with how stupid I was. I remember, like it was yesterday, driving on the 405 freeway north from San Diego to LA Airport and seeing on the right side, the east side of the 405 freeway, a great big billboard. This would have been late 2006. It said, borrow 125% of the value of your home. Bad credit, okay. Now, I wasn't a real estate lender at the time, and I wasn't primarily a real estate guy. It did occur to me driving my car that I was a credit guy, and the idea that you would loan somebody with a bad credit history 125% of the value of the collateral, it seemed to me that that would be problematic. I
Yeah, right.
didn't act on it. You know, it's important to say I didn't act on it. So those black swans might be more apparent than you otherwise believe, but you're so busy with your life that you don't look for signs of them. When I look at what scares me in the US market right now, it is the plethora of exchange traded funds, ETFs, that have invested in high yield. Sub-investment grade issuances. What scares me is that the top of that pyramid, the ETF, is extremely liquid, and there's trillions of dollars invested in them, often by mas and pas who don't have very much sophistication about credit or the economy, but want 150 basis points extra yield. They would rather get paid 5.2% in an ETF than 3.9 or 4% in a federally insured savings account. While the ETFs are extremely liquid, trading billions and billions and billions of dollars a day, the funds in the ETFs are often invested in very illiquid junk bonds. If we had sniffs of a credit quality problem, in 2026, like we had in 2008, and these mas and pas who were unconcerned about risk and concerned about yield came to be concerned about risk and began to sell the ETFs, the ETF managers would have to sell off illiquid assets to fund redemptions. And they'd have to do it overnight. They don't have a 3 to 6 month workout period like the banks do. Now, I have been through junk bond illiquidity periods in my life, like when Drexel Burnham blew up. And in the late 80s, early 90s, we had a saying where these junk bonds, we called them owl bonds. We called them owl bonds because if you owned them and you went to call your broker to sell them, your broker would say, "Too-hoo, too-hoo."
Right?
If I had to look at one thing that scares me about a 2008 style liquidity event, it would be the mismatch in duration and size between the junk bond ETFs and the underlying markets for the credits under them. By the way, I'm not saying on your show, Andy, that this is going to blow up, that this is going to happen. But I've searched my mind for things that could wreck my personal business plan. As Doug Casey says, for balloons in search of a pin. And that's the one that scares me the most.
Yeah, on that, I remember 2008, 2007. Number one, I don't mean this as a slap on my back or to stroke my own ego. I started buying in 2009-ish, 2000, when things were just, it was so bad. Hey, you're picking up really cheap assets that I believed in. But it was like, it was a dichotomy myself. I remember thinking in 2008, I was drinking a coffee outside of a Starbucks with my investor, if you would. I was running some money. And I remember we were talking, and it's like, and we were in cash, but we were thinking, well, is this it? Are we going to have to go buy a cabin out in the wilderness? It was that scary. And so that's always in the back of my mind here. And just seeing what we have now, I guess, looking at the indicators or just looking at the economy, it just, I'll never forget that is what I'm trying to say.
I've had several similar moments in my life. And I've often made mistakes during those moments. I remember, as an example, when very briefly the oil price went sub-zero, which is to say the market charged the oil companies money for taking the oil. That occurred simultaneously with Exxon being kicked out of the Dow Jones Industrial. So you had fundamental selling in Exxon because of a very weak oil price, and you had artificial selling because every index fund in the world had to sell Exxon. And the Exxon price didn't fall, it collapsed. And oddly, I waited for things to get worse. And I, by the way, I did a great job buying Exxon, but I bought it probably 7 weeks too late. And 7 weeks in this case equated to a 16 or 17% uplift in the share price before I was smart enough to, look. The lesson there was sometimes things are cheap enough. Could they go lower? Yes. Does it matter to you if you have a 5 to 10 year time frame? Absolutely not. It is easy for yourself and myself, despite the years we've had of this racket, to be impacted by groupthink, which is to say, although you have cash in a liquidity crisis, you don't have the balls to pull the trigger. You have to have both cash and courage to take advantage. I had a great discussion with my friend Doug Casey in the early part of the decade of the 80s, when real estate prices, but in particular real estate prices in Vancouver, were both he and I were interested in. The real estate prices, retail real estate prices in Vancouver, 81, 82, in that period of high mortgage rates, fell by 50%. And there were these foreclosures all over the place. And I was talking about the wealth destruction. I remember Doug turning to me and says, "There's been no wealth destruction. None. The house didn't go away. It's just that the wealth is going to go back to where it should have been to begin with, in strong hands, not weak hands. The wealth wasn't destroyed, it merely changed hands." And it's important in disruptions. Well, it's important in anticipating disruptions, whether you ask yourself, am I going to be a beneficiary or am I going to be a victim? If I choose to be a beneficiary, how do I get from here to there? It's important too, when the event occurs, that first of all, you've been prudent enough to have the tools, cash, and B, that you have enough courage of your convictions that you employ that cash when you are scared to death of the circumstances around you. Easy to say, tough to do. I got personally 2009 very, very, very right, because I'd prepared for it through three prior crashes. And if we have a crash in 2026 or 2027, 2028, I'm old, fat, bald, rich, experienced. I expect I'll do pretty well out of this one, but most people won't.
So about that, I remember very, again, going back to my own career and my own experience, I remember just thinking I had so much concern, so much fear. I was deeply afraid. And I just told myself, well, we're either never going to live again, or this is the cheapest it's ever been. And that's really how I overcame this fear. And also, just like, I just kept on thinking, I got to do the opposite of what I feel. I got to do the opposite of what I
Very
feel.
important. Very
So
important.
I did buy it.
No,
I did really
Andy,
well. Go ahead.
getting so afraid that you curl up in the corner in fetal condition guarantees you lose. It absolutely guarantees that you lose. How well you're prepared now will have an awful lot to do with how well you succeed if the event comes to pass. But if the event comes to pass, you need to view it arithmetically, as dispassionately as you're capable of viewing it. I've said on your show several times that I love hate. One of the nice things about a catastrophe is that there's hate everywhere. It's in abundance. It's just that you can't allow yourself to be consumed by it.
Yeah, and then you're going to see what you're made of if you really believe in that, if you really do believe in hate. So I really want to, and really I want to get to know oil and natural gas because it's so interesting to me. But before we do that, you have a boot camp. What's your next boot camp? Tell me about that, and how can people get their portfolio reviewed by yourself?
The upcoming boot camp, I'm embarrassed to say I don't know the exact date, but Callie can give you a link for it.
I'll get
It's
it.
hugely exciting. It's something we've never done before. You know, boot camps traditionally have been around a subject. It might be development stage assets, it might be the capital stack, it might be silver, it might be uranium. Boot camps, for those of your audience who don't know them, are 8 hour long deep dives into a subject. The idea giving being that we give you in 8 hours all of the background necessary to become an investor and a speculator in that space. We give you tapes because we give you more information in 8 hours than you can absorb in 8 hours. I put on the boot camps and I have to play the tapes. Okay, so when I say 8 hours, think 16 or 24. You have to play them two or three times. What's exciting to me about this boot camp is that rather than take a subject that is a commodity or a technique, we're taking a region. The northwestern part of British Columbia, the so-called Golden Triangle, has a mining history going back 150 years. I have a history with it personally going back to 1984. It is an area that is a rich producer, but is also very prospective for discoveries, particularly around copper, silver, and gold. It's an area that enjoys fantastic favor in Canada because it's local, perceived to be low risk. It's not low risk. And there's a lot of factors that go into understanding either investing or speculating in the Golden Triangle that are not broadly understood by the investing public. So we intend to give people an overview of the geology of the Golden Triangle. Importantly, an understanding of the politics of Canada, British Columbia, and the Golden Triangle, respectively. A discussion about the opportunities that both geology and sociology present. A subset of that, that part of BC is uniquely favorably endowed with sociology. It's a very sparsely settled part of British Columbia, and the demographics and the politics are First Nations. The First Nations there have a deep familiarity and a deep appreciation for mining. And we will, in the boot camp, delve very, very deeply with First Nations, Tahltan's participation in what the local people expect from and deliver to mining. To my knowledge, this type of thing will never have been done before in a public forum.
What a great idea.
I really look forward to this. There are probably 100 companies active in the Golden Triangle. Probably 90 of them aren't worth the piece of paper that they're printed on. The ebbs and flows of the fortunes of the triangle will impact the share prices of all of them, whether they deserve it or not. And so we're going to try to help people sort out the good from the bad, from the ugly, and come away with enough knowledge that they will be able to do the process for themselves going forward. Like all of our other investment products, this is $99. If for any reason you don't think you got your money's worth, email me, I'll give you your money back. I'm proud to say, in 40 years of offering solid gold money-back guarantees, I've had to refund about 0.1% of the tuitions charged. That notwithstanding, that money-back guarantee is your listeners' guarantee that we have every confidence in our product.
Excellent. I'll put a link. I'll reach out to Callie and I'll get that link and put it in the show notes, both on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify to all my viewers and listeners. So, Rick, I have been deploying some of my funds, as you have, into oil and natural gas, most recently into some small producing natural gas plays, if you would. Talk to me about that. The last time I had you on the show, you said that the natural gas sector specifically, and I'd also include oil, and I believe you included oil in that conversation, similar to where the gold market, or I should say the gold mining market was several years ago or a few years ago. I might be early. I probably am early. I'm fully expecting that. That being said, I couldn't agree with you more, but work that out for me, the play in natural gas and oil.
Well, your caveat is great. I think we are early. I think we are in a period of economic weakness, and it wouldn't surprise me to see both the oil and the gas quote go lower. If that happens, I think you could see share price weakness or decline in the sector. But as I said earlier in this interview, sometimes things are cheap enough. The companies are selling at between 30 and 40% discounts to what I think they're worth at today's commodity prices. And I think today's commodity prices are much higher 3 or 4 years from now. Here's why. Hate, first of all. The popular media and the intelligentsia, if that's what you want to call them, suggest to you that the oil is bad for things. I don't understand how they think they're going to fly their private jets to Davos to tell us to drive less without oil, but we'll leave that one aside for a moment. But the big thinkers of the world, the Angela Merkels, the Joe Bidens, my favorite energy physicist, Greta Thunberg, all say that peak oil demand occurs in 2030 or 2032, which is ridiculous. Peak oil demand won't occur in my lifetime. For the record, I'm a healthy 72-year-old. Likely won't occur in your lifetime, Andy. And when people do net present value calculations, if you cut off the calculation in 2032, you get a much lower tail value than if you cut off the calculation in 2065, which is when I counted out. But people hear me say that and they say, well, Rick, what about alternative energies? You know, isn't like electricity going to replace everything? Yeah, most electricity is generated from fossil fuels, including oil and gas. All forms of energy demand are going higher. It is estimated that in 2050, global energy demand is twice what it's going to be in 2025. Now, if you look back over the last 40 or 50 years, depending on who you ask, global investment in alternative energies is somewhere between $5 trillion, and the latest estimate I saw is $11 trillion. And that investment has lowered demand for carbon-based sources of energy from a high of 83% 40, 45 years ago to a low of 81% today. In other words, 2 percentage points. Yes, the market share of carbon-based fuels is going to go lower slowly, but the total demand for energy is going to double. It's important to know that. So, with regards to the oil complex generally, I would suggest that many companies are selling at 30 or 40% discounts to what they're worth, and 3 years from now they'll be worth twice as much as they are today. Here's why. In addition to the fact that demand isn't faltering, sustaining capital investments, those investments that you make to maintain your production and your cash flow, are off markedly. The International Energy Agency suggests that the global oil industry, including peristatals, is deferring $2 billion a day in sustaining capital investments.
Gosh.
Now, that doesn't necessarily impact your ability to produce in 2026. It starts to hurt in 2027, and it becomes really painful in 2028. And that doesn't include new project investments. If you look at a graph of new project investments in exploration, particularly non-conventional exploration, what you see is a really precipitous decline. The US rig count has fallen hard enough, but if you look at the rig count in offshore frontier oil and gas exploration, which is where the big discoveries are going to be made, the chart looks equivalent to throwing a boulder off a bridge. And that impacts things. It impacts things. What's interesting about the energy market to me is that you don't need to go down the quality trail to win. The biggest and the best oil companies in the world, the ExxonMobils of the world, are cheap. So you don't need to go like we used to have to do in the 1980s into the penny dreadfuls to find value. You can find value at the top of the feeding chain. I am going down the feeding chain because although I like the idea of probabilistic 25% compound internal rates of return for 5 years, I don't like it. I love it. I also like 10 baggers or 20 baggers. And there are very high quality people in the world now doing very high quality work in very small market caps that if they do the kind of work that they've done in their past, and if the pricing circumstance that I talk about in oil and gas is as I believe it to be, these will generate tenfold returns or 20-fold returns, and they'll do it in the 5-year time frame. So at the same time that I'm buying Exxon, I'm starting to loosen up my check writing hand to do private placements with very, very high caliber people who I've done business with before, where unlike in the gold business, because what they produce is hated, they have to give me a full warrant.
So you said something about 30 minutes ago, where putting on your banker hat, that a lot of these companies, and correct me if I'm wrong, the oil and gas companies were hard, it was hard to find capital. That's why that goes into, I mean, that goes into hate, right? And that also goes into that goes into so many different things, not only hate and, just say as a proxy, if you would, but also the need for capital. So they're willing to get you a deal, if you would, as an investor. But it also has huge implications, correct me if I'm wrong, on supply, because they're not spending money unless it's on the very best project. So not as much is going to be produced, correct?
Listen, if I'm ExxonMobil, if I'm an investment grade credit, I don't have any trouble with my senior revolving credit facility. Not a problem. But if I'm a credit that has a 30 or 40 year track record, my senior secured revolving credit facility, which used to be a prime based facility, not a prime based, a prime facility, and had 40 or 45 participants competing, is now getting non-renewal notice. And what was a prime-based facility is now a prime plus two facility. From a lender's point of view, if you are an oil and gas investor as opposed to a generalist, you are looking at a revolving credit facility based on proved developed producing reserves at 50% of net asset value. With a redetermination annually, with the credit priced at prime plus two, floating. From a banker's point of view, it just doesn't get better than this. It absolutely doesn't get better than this. Through a lot of my career as a banker, I was constrained as to, frankly, what I could get away with by Wells Fargo, by J.P. Morgan Chase, by Chase Manhattan, by the big energy banks. But in the credits below investment grade, those guys are walking away from the market, which is to say they are giving me the type of private credit that they formerly were trying to kill me to keep me out of. I'm delighted to have that size opportunity presented to me in a subject I know well this late in life.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. What would you tell retail investors? How do and maybe this is a boot camp idea for you, but yeah, how do you evaluate then, or what would you say to a retail investor that wants to get in the space and the small going down the food chain, if you would? How would you start evaluating? What advice would you give in evaluating the companies?
First of all, I would ask those investors to determine whether or not they actually wanted to go down
Right?
the value chain. I mean,
Yeah.
if you're buying Exxon, the best company in the business, at a 4% dividend yield, Where that 4% is after buying back stock, after making sustaining capital investments, after funding a series of discoveries in Guyana that are big enough to move the dial on Exxon, and after they paid $60 billion to buy Pioneer. If you're buying that at a 40% discount to net present value, where it is very likely in the 3 to 5 year timeframe that net present value doubles or triples, do you actually care about going after alpha when beta is so cheap? I mean, I wouldn't be surprised at all if Exxon tripled in 5 years. If you get a triple in 5 year with a 4% yield, which is to say, if your cost of funds is flat, pretty attractive. If you're Rick Rule, you're curious and you're terminally greedy, then yes, you begin to come down the feeding chain simply because you have no competition. And you remember earlier points in time in your life when you had no competition and you made a boatload of money.
That would be me.
So when the circumstance is hated, again, you get to buy best in class. And best in class early stage all involves people. Have the people been serially successful in oil and gas? Not somebody who was successful in biotech or mining, but in oil and gas. How much of their own money are they putting in alongside yours? In other words, is this an ugly promote round? Did they make themselves 50 million shares for free? And now they're letting you into a so-called seed round at 25 cents? In other words, where there's 100%, pardon me, 100-fold markup. And is the success that they enjoyed in the past, how does that relate to the task at hand? If they were successful in the Middle East and they're now exploring in Oklahoma, is that past success germane to the task at hand? I'm looking at an opportunity that was actually presented to me this morning, which is why it's fresh in my mind. From an opportunity from an entrepreneur who retired 5 years ago, but just can't resist getting back in the market because of the opportunities. This is a person who I've made money with for 35 years. He is has been backed for 35 years by one of the preeminent oil families in the world. He has been serially successful in high-risk offshore exploration, and he is going to become active in high-risk exploration, backed by this same family. It might not work. Oh, and by the way, he will take 10% of the offering on the same terms that he shows it to me, and it comes with a full 5 year warrant. Now, you get amalgamations of butchers and bakers and candlestick makers in the gold business right now, people with no track record of anything other than failures, active in nothing, nowhere deposits, unbacked by anybody, and they won't give you a full warrant. So I got a choice between backing the Three Stooges in an industry in favor or backing high pedigree superstars in circumstances where I'm one of the least competent investors in the capital stack and I get a full 5 year warrant. Guess where I want to be?
You gotta we gotta wrap up here, but anything that you would want to tell our viewers and listeners, really, until the next time I have you on, anything to look out for? What are some final thoughts?
Well, I would just ask people to look at their own behavior over the last 3 months,
Great question.
or over the last 2 years. You know, 2 years ago, Andy, you and I had to beg people to buy gold and beg people to buy the gold stocks.
Now they're calling me.
Three or 4 weeks ago, when I was selling my gold stocks, there was lots of social media commentary that I was an idiot. Now, the GDXJ is off 22 or 23%. And people are leery to advance, leery to invest. People who loved the GDX 20% higher than it is today are nervous about it today. If you were right then, the fact that it's 20% cheaper would seem to me to be an advantage, not a disadvantage. And people who pay attention to their investment premise, and whether their investment premise is true or not, need to ask themselves why they would rather pay more than pay less.
Well said, Rick. People want to do business with you. If they want their portfolio reviewed, how do they get in touch with you? How do they find you?
Yeah, if you like what I have to say about natural resources, do you want to personalize it? Go to my website, ruleinvestmentmedia.com. List your natural resource stocks, and for free, I'll evaluate it. One being best, 10 being worst. I'll comment on individual issues if I think my comments might have value. Don't send me an email saying, for free, give me your 10 best picks. That won't happen. Please, by the way, no crypto stocks. Please, no pot stocks. Please, no techno stocks. Leave me to do what I do well. Also, you can see my shirt. If for some reason you're unhappy with your current bank, my bank's about to be live. In fact, it's live now, but it won't be live to the public until January. Check out battlebank.com. As an example, if you're interested in receiving interest on your checking account, check out Battle Bank. If you want to access credit secured by gold, silver, platinum, or palladium, check out Battle Bank. If you want to save federally insured in 20 currencies, not just the US dollar, check out Battle Bank. If your bank can't do that, or if your bank can't answer the phone, again, check out Battle Bank.
Rick, it's always a pleasure. I'm really looking forward to having you on again very soon.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate the opportunity.
It's always my pleasure.